soldiers and wanted to be pleased by what they saw as a real man. Princesses did the same, and some were more cutthroat than queens. They knew kings had power, but were weak men. Without warriors, there would be no kings. Without warriors, there would be no presidents, no emperors. I sat near Arizona, let the chair recline back, and closed my eyes. Sierra came back into our section, sat across from us, sipping a chocolate martini. Her energy ran through me, made me open and close my hands. I smelled her fragrance and the subtle scent of the chocolate in her drink, felt her lust without opening my eyes. She smelled so good, my toes curled. She smelled like bad news dancing with trouble. She changed the channel in the flat screen, began watching Breaking Bad. Arizona snapped, "Who the fuck told you to change the channel?" Sierra threw the remote at Arizona. "From oil and vinegar to oil and water." Arizona shot her sister a look. "Pick it up." Sierra picked up the remote, put the television back on CNN and the news about the world financial crisis. She then took her drink and walked away, her ass moving like it was screaming and cursing. But she was back in less than a minute, fresh drink in her hand. She put the urn in the seat next to her and sat next to her brother, legs crossed, calm, stoic. She blamed Arizona for their brother's death. Soon they would be in another civil war that rivaled the war between the noble families in Westeros. As Coltrane played, I sat between sisters with the sense of angels and demons, con women who had tried to kill each other once upon a time, and who might do the same again. Friends close, enemies closer, and family closer than close. What the assassin called Hawks had said stayed on my mind. She had proof that there were more falsehoods from Catherine. Thelma still existed. She was hidden in plain sight. Then, as Sierra had done, only for a different reason, I sighed softly. I said, "Do you know what a moment is?" Arizona looked at me like I was a fool. "A moment is a moment. A moment is a medieval unit of time and equals 90 seconds. Back in the Middle Ages, when they used sundials, they measured time in moments, so an hour had 40 moments instead of 60 minutes. Why are you telling me that bullshit? So I can get my mind off death and killing? For a moment. Is that supposed to be a joke? Not really. Just needed to put something else in my head." My trigger finger moved back and forth, hiccuping. Sierra stared at me. She sipped her drink and stared. Man or money, she wasn't afraid to steal from a con woman. Again, I saw what Scams the Elder and his son had seen in Sierra. I understood why they took 30 pieces of silver. Arizona saw her sister looking at me. She jumped up and slapped her, cursed her out in Tagalog, then in English told her younger sister if she ever crossed her again, she'd end up back in Amsterdam doing live sex shows. Sierra picked up the urn that housed the ashes of her dead brother. Ass wagging, enraged, she marched to a section in the rear of the G650. I was right. One war had ended. Another had started. But that war wasn't my war. I still had my own. Chapter 31. Gotham. Wearing jeans and a t-shirt, I moved through summer heat and battled traffic on I-95, crossed the Hudson River and made my way to the Upper East Side of Manhattan. It was almost 90 degrees and muggy, each inhale disgusting, like sucking on the exhaust of a car, but being in motion felt good. I rocked a Ducati Street Fighter. Being on two wheels kept me from feeling trapped. I threaded the needle, dodged cars, pedestrians, buses, and a sea of yellow cabs. An hour ago, with a handshake goodbye, Arizona had left me on the tarmac in New Jersey at Teterboro, just across the George Washington Bridge, a short distance from the Lincoln Tunnel, in a city that had as much traffic on its streets as it did on the sidewalks, a Gotham that was always in a hurry. I sped and threaded the needle through traffic until I was near Central Park, not far from the Met Breuer Museum. I found a space to park in front of my destination, then reached into my backpack and pulled out a New York Yankees baseball cap, eased on dark wayfarers. While he was distracted, I slipped past the Upper East Side doorman, didn't look back toward Park Avenue and 75th Street. I hesitated before I stepped on the elevator, then backed away and found the stairs. Cameras were in the stairwell, so I kept my head down, climbed to the 20th floor. I eased down the hallway and tapped on the door for Unit B. A woman opened the door. She was in her 20s, slender, dressed in black. Her hair cascaded over her shoulders. Like I had done on that plane, I noticed her perfume. Gucci. She told me her name was Yana. In Russian, I said, "My name is Gideon." "Do you have a weapon, Gideon?" "Several, in my backpack."
"I will need your backpack."
I handed it to her. She handed me a claim tag. She asked,
"Do you mind?"
"Go ahead." She searched me, found nothing. She said,
"Remove your baseball cap and sunglasses, please."
She stepped aside and I entered the gracious entry gallery. It felt like the home of a diplomat. Yana led me into an elegant living room. Russian mafia music played and could be heard in the seven rooms, was piped into the five bathrooms of this $14 million property. Many Russians were in the apartment, all dressed in suits and ties. Food and drinks were being served by Russian waiters and waitresses. There was an open bar. People chatted and some danced their Russian dances. The man in the white shoes entered the room to loud applause. He was holding hands with his smiling wife. He looked like Cary Grant, and she looked like the Italian actress Gina Lollobrigida. Konstantin had finished his chemotherapy. This was his celebration. He came to me, shook my hand, then pulled me to him, and we hugged like family. He sighed, looked relieved. In Russian, he said, "Son, you vanished and had me worried. I thought they had you." "I know, Konstantin, I know. You didn't follow my orders." "I had to go. They would have found us all, one by one. Not for the cancer. I would have been at your side. I couldn't let you go back. Now sit. Drink. Tell us how you killed those motherfuckers." I was in a room filled with people in the same business. Husbands and wives. Most were over 60. Their days doing wet works were behind them. I was the youngest face in the place. First, we damned cancer and toasted to Constantine's kicking its ass. Then gangsters and their lovers heard my tale of David fighting many Goliaths. They toasted me with drinks raised high. They chanted my name. They said my name like I was the Gideon from the Bible, the military man, a leader who, despite having the numerical disadvantage, had defeated the Midianite army. I drank with them like they were family and celebrated Constantine being better. He treated me like I was his son. I respected him like he was my father. Then I needed to see my brothers and confront my mother. Days later, I went back to Atlanta. I went to visit Alvin White's gravesite. I went to Atlanta Memorial Depot and paid for a marble headstone. Then, on an overcast day, I sat there with my friend's spirit for a while. I assured him that his children would be taken care of. But money was no substitute for a father like him. Money would never fix his wife's devastated heart or lessen her unmeasurable grief. Then I had gone to see Catherine and the boys. I upgraded the panic room with reinforced walls. I installed a vault door that led to that space. The door was hidden behind a mirror. I put televisions and a MacBook Pro in the panic room. It was stocked with food, guns, ammo. The boys helped me. I took the boys to skate, took them bowling, took them rock climbing, and then I drove them and Catherine out to Woodstock. I took them to the field we used to go to with shotgun for target practice. We set up bottles and cans to gun down. There wasn't a house for at least a mile in any direction. Out where conservatives and the NRA roamed, I showed my mother how to load and use a gun. First, I let her try popping off with a .22, then switched to a .380. She killed a few bottles, but missed 4 out of 5 shots. My brothers were hitting 7 out of 10. They were becoming little marksmen. Catherine didn't like guns. She said,
"So much violence in machismo."
While the boys were target practicing, she walked a few feet away. I followed her, then stood next to her and watched the boys. She said,
"Hawks and the Bajan saved us."
They did.
They watched over you.
He had sent people to slaughter us, to kill me and my sons.
That was the plan.
Is he really dead? I know I have asked you that so many times, but are you sure? I am still afraid, very afraid. Is Mr. Midnight really dead?
I took out my phone. I showed her the images of Medianoche after his fall from grace. I studied her fear. Her face lost its color.
You should have dismembered and burned his body. You should have dragged his carcass through the streets for what he has done.
Her anger, the fear, and coldness surprised me. I popped my lips. Mr. Midnight was my father. She pulled her lips in, but said nothing as her mood changed. I said, let's walk over there and talk.
About?
Lies that have been told. 40 yards from the boys, when I stopped walking, she stood next to me, gun in hand, lips twisted, much on her mind as she kicked dirt. Her voice was uneven.
What lies, Jean-Claude?
My mother wore slim jeans, pink chucks, white t-shirt, Atlanta Braves baseball cap. She looked young, small and delicate. I had on worn Levi's and an aged Batman t-shirt, brown steel-toe boots that had seen better days. Everything I had on I had picked up at Goodwill. I said, I need us to be honest with each other.
What have I done wrong this time?
I told her there were hidden cameras in the house. I told her that was how I was able to look inside of her home. I used my phone, connected to the system, and let her view what I could see when I had monitored the house in Powder Springs. I revealed where each camera was located. She was outraged.
Why would you put cameras in my home?
I put the phone away. To protect you and my brothers.
You are far away, and somehow a camera is supposed to protect us? You lie. Why would you violate my privacy in such a way? You bring me to America, give me a house, then put cameras in almost every room so you can spy on me? Is that house my prison or my home?
I will give you the codes, the password, and you can change it to whatever you want it to be. You can look in the house before you come home. At night, you can monitor outside and be sure you're safe.
Secret cameras? That was how you knew about Jeremy.
Yeah, that's how.
You will not be able to spy inside my home after this day?
Not unless you want me to keep surveillance.
Why would you do that to someone?
You know why. Because of what you did to me when I was your boy. She shuddered.
I am not that person. I was young, stupid, afraid.
Tell me about Nathalie Marie Massieres. Tell me about Yer. She kicked dirt and shook her head.
Leave my past in the past.
Is there any secret you have I need to know?
Alvin White is dead. Let that be enough. Let that be your guilt. Let that be the pillow made of rock you try to sleep on each night.
My jaw tightened and my trigger finger began to hiccup. She said,
Robert's mother and Alvin are dead because of you. Live with that. Lose sleep over that. I have every night. I suffer every night.
I suffer both day and night. I will take the hit on Robert's mother. I was careless. That was my fault. Alvin White is dead because he came back here to try and protect you from all of this bullshit you created.
Shot many times. Pulled from the river like he was a dead animal. I was his teacher. You involved him in that ugly part of your life, not me.
I don't want to fight with you. She snapped.
Then stop whatever you're doing.
I just asked a couple of simple questions.
Stop interfering with my life. Stop spying on me.
Sure, Nathalie, sure. She looked me in my eyes.
Va te faire foutre, Gideon.
She cursed me and called me Gideon as an insult. In French, I asked, who was Jeremy Bentham?
I don't know any more than what I have already told you.
He wasn't a horseman. They don't take you on dates and buy you popcorn before seducing you. They blow your brains out and move on.
Then who was he? Why me? What did he want from me?
Don't know. Not yet. The truth always shows up. Remember that. Sooner or later, every lie has an expiration date. Every lie, large or small. I took a breath. Did Loverboy Jeremy ever use your computer?
When we were at Barnes & Noble. Yes, for a few minutes.
Did you watch him?
No, I was reading a novel and drinking café. I trusted him.
Either he planted a virus or stole your personal information. Your computer is no good. Give it to me. I'll get you another one today. Change your email address. The banking I set up for you and the boys, any account you have, change all of your passwords, including Wi-Fi.
Jesus, this is too much. All of this is too much.
Has anyone contacted you looking for him?
No one. I did like you told me to do. Once or twice a day, I have called his number pretending I was looking for him. Today I will call and say I am hurt that he has not returned my calls. Sound sad, be angry, tell him I can take a hint, cry, and say that I will never bother him again.
Good, good.
Where is his body?
It will never be found. Not without an archaeological dig. She took a few hard breaths.
He used me. Like every man I have ever met, he used me. When a man does that, when he lies to have sex with a woman, when it is done, the woman feels as if she has been raped.
He was after more than sex. This was deeper. Sex was his foreplay. He wasn't around long enough for you to feel like you'd been fucked. Her voice cracked.
He found me. Tricked me. Used me.
Get over it. You've used many people, in your own way.
I don't use people.
You sent me to kill. You did that. My mother put a weapon in my hand and sent me to kill. Then she lied and kept most of the money. She clacked her teeth twice.
Let's not do this, Jean-Claude.
You put a weapon in my hand and sent me to kill.
Fucking get over it.
There she is, Thelma, hiding behind Catherine's smile. She regarded her gun, then deepened her scowl. I said, you know how to use it. It's loaded.
You are cold and abusive. No different than Mr. Midnight.
You don't like my tone? Then kill me. End this shit. This is who I am. I've gone too far down this road to turn around. I can't put my gun away and become an electrical engineer. That was my dream when I was a kid. You put a knife in my hand. You sent me to kill. And the things I have done to save you? You don't want to know the things I have done.
When you are angry, you sound like him. That terrifies me.
Like who? Medianoche? Or the Beast? She dropped her gun like it burned her hand, let it land in the dirt. Dark secrets made her lip tremble. I asked, who is Andrew Sven's father? You've never said. Catherine hurried away from me, ran hard, then slowed when she was near the boys. I watched her and wondered what information Hawks had found. I wondered what she knew about my mother's life in Yer. I wondered what Hawks was refusing to tell me. I wanted to know what the fuck my mother was hiding. I felt Mr. Midnight and the Beast were part of a bigger secret. I picked up her gun, took a few steps, then jogged and stopped near her. She told Andrew Sven and Robert it was time to end target practice. The boys ran over to her, saw she was crying. Robert asked,
what's wrong, Mum? We were talking about Alvin White, and I became sad. I told Jean-Claude how beautiful the funeral was. I told him about Alvin's brothers. They are big men, boxers like Alvin, and they cried like they were little boys. His wife cried, and his children cried out for their daddy, and that made everyone in the church break down. 100 people came to see him off. He did nice things for so many. I told your brother how everyone spoke and said Alvin White was a good man. I told him how the tears started again when they put dirt on his coffin. Now I am crying again.
Andrew Sven hugged his mother as she wiped away her tears.
My mother was as good as lying as I was at killing. Her lie was powerful enough to make me need to step away and wipe my own eyes.
Chapter 32. Strangers. As I'd done night and day since the battle in Argentina, I snapped awake and grabbed the gun stationed on the nightstand. Within a blink, I was on my feet and the 9mm was trained in the direction of the abrupt sound. The problem didn't reveal itself. Hugged the darkness. I was 7 years old again, and Mr. Midnight was in the shadows. The noise came back, and I saw my enemy. The sound that had pulled me from my nightmare had come from my phone. A new text message alert had made it vibrate on the desk. I exhaled, eased the tightness in my chest, the same for the pressure in my head. Then I moved by Tumi luggage, stepped over a t-shirt that said Oblissons la Proveté, and other clothing scattered on the carpet, over three pairs of shoes, and picked up my work phone. It was next to the satellite phone, the Thuraya I had been given on behalf of Senorita Reina Ebeya.
Whatcha up to? I'm not one to cock about, so I just want you to know that I miss you already. Hope it's okay to say that sort of thing. Glad I got to see you again.
It was a text from the arms dealer in London. Zankana. Zed. Bolshi. She was reaching out to me over a secure network isolated from the mainstream, a network that required special software to enable communication. Another coded message came while I held my phone. Enjoyed spending time snogging with you at Rose Pub and Kitchen, New Cross. Had a blast at Star Wars the Musical. I'm about to send you something. Hope you don't find it offensive. I'm having kittens about it, because it's not the kind of thing I normally would do. But I want you to stay as Randy for me as I have become for you.
I texted her back a smiley face. She sent me another message, a nude photo. Her tattoos, the scorpion that ran down her body, her hair, her skin.
Zankana was a fit work of art, one of the best bods I'd ever seen.
For your eyes only, smiley face. Don't want you to forget me, smiley face. I guess I'm trying to say I fancy you. Hope that keeps things from being woolly. We'll take more and send more pics if you want.
Well, I did take more. Just send a smiley face if you want to see them.
Smiley face. You are devastatingly handsome with your face healed.
Weapons at my side. I sent the arms dealer a dozen smiley faces, followed by X's and O's. For a moment, I wished I had stayed in London. She was in this business. She understood me better than most. I had done what I had to do. I had told her about the nightmares. I saw enemies both new and old when I closed my eyes. The nights I was with her, I had jerked awake at least a dozen times. Once, I woke up screaming. I took slow breaths. Chest was wrapped in steel bands. I broke free, then shook off a chill and looked at the shoes and clothing on the floor. I went to my backpack, took out a BC powder, downed it with water. For 6 days, this suite in Paris had been my 5-star safe house. I put the phone down, crept back to the window, cracked the thick curtains. Europeans who were out wore heavy coats, parkas, gloves, scarves, boots. Snow fell, and the grandness of Paris twinkled at me. The well-lit Eiffel Tower minutes away. I was hiding at the Shangri-La Hotel. I wish Shotgun had lived to see this city. He would have loved to be able to see the black Americans and Africans speaking French in Paris. I caught my reflection in the glass and saw someone behind me. The sudden movement jarred me. My trigger finger tensed up.
Boo, you all right over there?
A light on one of the nightstands clicked on. Living in a mental hell, I saw heaven. Sweet brown skin, virgin white covers pulled up to her small waist. 2 shades of makeup had stained the saintly sheets. She turned on her side, faced me with her eyes barely open. I lowered my weapon. Didn't mean to wake you up, Lola Mac.
Were you about to sneak out without saying goodbye again?
No, wasn't leaving. Not about to bounce. Not yet.
You're going to that other part of Paris to handle your business?
Yeah. Yeah. Soon. Later today. Before nightfall.
Want some company? You said it's a short train ride from here.
You can't go with me. Might not be safe.
You okay?
Give me a moment. Shotgun was on my mind. Just a moment.
You've done that every night. Stood in the window. You're looking at your reflection over and over like you've never seen yourself before.
Over the last few weeks, I had reached out to women I had left without saying goodbye. I still hadn't called Angelina. The look she'd had in her eyes when she ran into me in Brazil haunted me. The instant, tears troubled me. Weeks ago when I was in Atlanta, I'd called Jewel Stuark and left a message. She was ATL's top newscaster. We had met in a jazz club a while ago, Sambuca Jazz Cafe. 2 hours after that, we had a room at the W Hotel by Perimeter Mall. We had had dinner in the room, talked, laughed, had sex, then rested on the bed and watched the news. Boys who had been outraged and needed revenge after 9-1-1, boys who were eager to kill the Taliban, had ended up in Iraq. Everyone was fighting a bad war. Everyone was in the wrong war. When I was passing through Miami, I'd reached out to Mickey Morioka, a waitress I had met at Tootsie's Cabaret. She had married 2 weeks before, was just getting back from her honeymoon in Las Vegas. I congratulated her, and she waved it off, wasn't excited about being hitched. She told me it was a marriage of convenience, so her child could have some sort of a father at home, and she needed the financial security. Kids were expensive, and private schools weren't cheap. She told me that as we sat naked on a towel placed on the sands of Howlover Beach in Miami Beach, Florida, it was my first time at a nude beach. Mickey said,
"Let's go to your room and, you know, get busy. Don't mean to rush you. I have to get my kid from the sitter, then make dinner."
When we were done having sex, before she kissed me goodbye, she had said,
"Sekuni Yokata, it is always so good to see you, Jean-Claude. Always. Next time, I'll cook something from my recipe book."
Then I had felt like I was in the world alone and called Lola Mack. She heard my voice and made me feel like it was Christmas. I told her I was in Miami wrapping up a few things, but had to go to Paris. She was in between acting jobs, had been busy planning her own wedding, but dropped everything because she wanted to meet me here. She hadn't seen me in years, not since I had left the Cayman Islands suddenly. She wanted to be with me again. My world was safer now. Not safe, but safer. Not every question had been answered. So I booked the actress Lola Mack a first-class ticket. At Charles de Gaulle Airport, she had run and jumped into my arms. Dinner at Le Grand Véfour, a show at Moulin Rouge, and a shopping spree on Champs-Élysées, Rue de Passy, and Rue de Faubourg Saint-Honoré had made up for any perceived wrong I had done. Bags from Gucci, Yves Saint Laurent, and Christian Dior were all over the suite. Lola Mack whispered,
"Put your gun down, boo. Come here. It's cold out there, colder than a witch's tit in a brass bra. Your balls are gonna shrink."
"You're tired. You've only been asleep 2 hours. Rest."
"I'll give you head-to-toe deep tissue massage."
"You know how that will end up, right?"
"I'll end up on my back with my feet on your chest."
"I was thinking with you face down, ass up."
"I love it when your balls slap against me over and over."
"You're incorrigible."
"I like big balls, and I cannot lie."
"Simply incorrigible." She smiled, her mouth wide and generous.
"Don't argue. Let me put you to sleep."
I picked up a cup of cafe I had left on the dresser, took two swallows to get the taste of BC powder out of my mouth, then eased back into the large bed. I kissed Lola Mack. Her tongue was sweet, like expensive wine. My skin was cold against hers, as cold as my dreams. As cold as the men I had fought since I was a little boy. Her warmth felt like heaven.
"I didn't come all the way to Paris to sleep without you."
"You came to sleep with me."
"When I leave here,
I want to be bow-legged."
I sucked her ear, sucked her neck, kissed her shoulders. She put me inside her, slow and easy. I filled her up. Lola Mack covered her own mouth, muffled her moans, but with each stroke, she set free soft cries.
"Lola Mack, what are you doing?"
That drowsy voice came from the other side of the king-size bed, beyond Lola Mack. Mrs. Jones pulled the sheets away from over her head and yawned. Lola Mack was a few years younger than I was, and Mrs. Jones was a few years older. She was young, but a more mature woman. Lola Mack sang,
"Wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up, and help me."
Mrs. Jones fluffed her hair, sat up, picked up the glass of 1999 Domaine Leroy Mussigny on her side of the bed. She was an attorney, divorced, born in Jamaica, but raised in middle-class Los Angeles.
"Good Lord."
Mrs. Jones sipped liquid power in finesse that cost $4,000 a bottle, then chuckled,
"He's going to blow your back out."
Mrs. Jones leaned in, slapped Lola Mack's beautiful brown booty over and over, playfully gave her corporal punishment for waking her. Mrs. Jones whispered, "So erotic, sensual. It's beautiful." I said, "You're next. Don't you dare threaten me with a good time." Lola Mack made me turn over. She took me in her mouth. The warmth pulled my mind away from thoughts of killing and death. This was better than morphine. My breathing no longer felt trapped in my chest. I took long, intense breaths, ignored the flashes behind my eyes, hummed, held her long brown hair, felt her breathing deeply, slowly. Mrs. Jones said, "Damn, Lola. Damn, look at you." I reciprocated, went down on Lola Mack, gave her tongue and fingers until she told me she wanted more. I eased between her sweet brown thighs, grinded against her, sucked her cheek, kissed her shoulders. She eased me back inside. It aroused her and calmed me. Mrs. Jones whispered, "I love watching you two make love." Soon it was Mrs. Jones on her belly, face down, moans rising. Lola Mack sipped wine and watched, then joined in. All of us together in the same bed. This felt like yesterday as well. Once upon a time, years ago, for a season, I'd retired and lived the perfect hedonistic, decadent lifestyle with Lola Mack and Mrs. Jones. We made love like we were trying to escape pain and find something better than the world had offered. I fucked to calm the noise in my head, to make the flashing go away. We moved around the bed, evolved from position to position, from triangle to triangle, until Mrs. Jones mounted me, reverse cowgirl. As Mrs. Jones rose and fell, Lola Mack kissed me again. It was one hell of a honeymoon kiss. She inhaled my moans, then she backed away, crawled, and faced Mrs. Jones, singing. Lola Mack was playful. She touched the attorney's face and lips. Then Lola Mack went to her bags, pulled out two vibrators. After playtime with the toys, after being upside down in my arms, both of them were on the bed, exhausted. I was an assassin, but I had also grown up in many brothels. I had my father's blood, and I had my mother's blood. I knew just as many ways to please as I did to kill. But that hadn't been enough for Arizona, not at the start. And it hadn't been enough for Hawks, not in the end. Lola Mack asked, "Did you come?" I shook my head. "Just wanted to please both of you."
"You're pretty hard."
"Yeah, still."
"It's not good for a man to be that excited and not finish."
"Not good for his health?"
"Not good for my ego."
Mrs. Jones whispered, "Touch yourself." Enthralled, still wiggling her ass from side to side, Lola Mack looked at me and said,
"I love it when you jack off and come."
Mrs. Jones whispered, "Masturbate for us."
"Yeah, make yourself come."
"Do like we used to do on 7 Mile Beach."
"Hell yeah!"
I sat on the edge of the bed, and the goddesses were on their knees, their hands on my thighs, watching me, giggling, waiting. They ran their hands over my skin and kissed my flesh.
"Slow it down." "Yeah, like that."
I did what they asked. "Like a good whore." Mrs. Jones whispered,
"I love it when you stroke yourself, the way it sounds. This shit is so fucking hot. I'm calling dibs." "Oh, we're about to fight."
My orgasm made me moan in pain and pleasure. It didn't want to end. They moved my hand away and took control, stroked me and imbibed until I was dry. While I lay on my back, panting, struggling to come down, they laughed, said I fed them well. Not long after we had showered again and sipped water, Lola Mack was on the bed, nude, finally sleeping. I stood in the window, still naked. Mrs. Jones was in my arms, her back to my chest. She held my gun, like she was my protector, or to keep me from leaving La Vie Lumière anytime soon. She rocked in my arms.
"Will it be dangerous in here?"
"Everywhere I go, danger waits. Blade sharpened, gun loaded." The gun was in Mrs. Jones's left hand. She put her right hand behind her, between my legs, and held onto my cock like it was a leash. Argentina, Medianoche, the beast, Catherine. Yeah. Mrs. Jones interrupted my thoughts.
What are you thinking?
I rocked her, made my smile turn upside down.
Nothing.
Your breathing changed. You stopped blinking. I watched your reflection in the mirror. You were gone. You were no longer in this room. I'm here, Mrs. Jones. I'm right here. I told myself that one day I'd leave this occupation again, for good. Before the hangman found me and put his noose around my neck, I'd get a woman, make her my wife, have a child, buy a house, be a square, and never have to run again, not even from the IRS. Across the room, Lola Mack stirred, then turned over. Mrs. Jones leaned back into me, again serious, and took nervous breaths. I held her a little tighter, absorbed her anxiety, added it to mine. Mrs. Jones hummed, then twisted her lips.
Lola Mack loves you.
I know.
She will cancel all her auditions and her wedding if you ask her to. She will leave the life she knows and run away with you if you ask.
I know. She whispered.
I adore you too. I've missed you so much.
A woman told me I only knew how to fuck. And the better a man fucked, the more a woman was convinced he was making love to her. Mrs. Jones put the gun down, hand-combed her bushy hair, then turned to me, put her arms around my neck, kissed my lips a dozen times before she put her head against my chest. I looked at the window again, stared at my reflection as I enjoyed the kindness of her skin against mine. Behind us, a phone vibrated. At first I thought it was the satellite phone that Abeja Reina had given me. It was the other phone. She said,
just when I had you to myself.
She gradually let me go to the electronic leash. The message was coded. It had bounced through a dozen servers in twice as many countries. I turned on an app and decoded the gibberish.
You don't know me, but I am identified as MX-401. It is possible that I may need your assistance in liberating MX-999, the man you know as the Bajan. I will know within the next 5 to 7 days. This is to put you on notice that your skills and help may be needed. Please advise.
The West Indian man who had saved my mother and brothers was in trouble, like I had been in trouble. The Bajan had problems. Shotgun had never turned his back on me. I would be the same way with the Bajan. I replied,
send consultation fee. A representative will contact you forthwith.
10 seconds later, the phone buzzed again. I didn't have to pick it up. I knew the message.
Funds transferred.
My anxiety level jumped from level 4 to level 7. Whoever the fuck MX-401 was, he was unknown to me. He was on the Bajan's team. That was all I needed to know. I would go now if I could, if I was needed. They would contact me soon. That meant I needed to rush and take care of business in Yer. Maybe I never should have invited Lola Mack and Mrs. Jones to Paris and gone to Yer 6 days ago. I could go bundle up, walk out into what was once called Panam by the locals and Lutetia by the Romans. Yer and the secrets it held were why I had come back to France. Hawks had turned over the right stones. It felt like she had turned over a boulder. That boulder was on my shoulders the way Atlas held the world. The information she had, she had given it all to me months later. She had found what could be my birth certificate. I was born in France. I was born in Yer. Birth certificates don't have photos. Birth certificates have the name of the subject at birth, the date of birth, place of birth, parents' names, file date, and tell if it was a live birth, tell if it was a multiple birth. What Hawks gave me said I was born a twin. It said that both twins were born alive. The truth of truths could be in Yer. When I looked in that direction, the hairs on the back of my neck stood up. My guts were telling me that there was trouble. I detected danger, had no idea what kind. It scared me. Someone had run my mother out of Yer, and I might have a sibling. One war ended, and another always rose to take its place. I held a mature woman in my arms, but looked at my reflection. Behind us, Lola Mack asked,
are you leaving?
She was on her side, watching us, her lips pulled in. Lola Mack frowned.
I heard that special phone vibrate,
Mrs. Jones whispered.
He's leaving us again.
I said, yeah, need to get there as soon as I can.
Then you'll come back? We want to keep you safe.
Then I have to go off to parts unknown to work.
From danger to danger.
Yeah. Danger to danger.
Without us?
Without you. Lola Mack took a deep breath, looked unhappy as she rose from the bed. She moved around bags and luggage, stepped over the results of our shopping spree, came to Mrs. Jones and me, put her arms around us. Lola Mack said,
Mrs. Jones, you hold on to one of his legs and I'll hold the other. We should hobble him like they did Kunta Kinte.
I kissed Mrs. Jones. Then I kissed the tears on Lola Mack's face. As Paris began to rumble, as the rising sun broke through winter smog and reflected against the whiteness of snow, silence covered us. I wouldn't leave them abruptly, not the way I had before, not the way I had left Angelina Maldonado at the end of the world. Angelina hated me. I could tell she would always hate me. Hawks was gone. Arizona was in my rear view. Lola Mack and Mrs. Jones kept me anchored. I would stay with them as long as I could. Yeah, I would have to wait a little longer. The truth wouldn't change. Truth was concrete, fixed. Only lies changed with every conversation. Thelma's truth would be there whenever I arrived. Many had tried to kill me, and I had killed more warriors than a soldier did in a war. Because of Mr. Midnight. Because of Medianoche's rage. Medianoche. His name would be forever etched into my brain. I had already killed a monster. Monsters. I wasn't ready to shake awake another one, because even the first monster wasn't fully dead. The packages from DNA Solutions were back, had been back a while. Both were in FedEx boxes at the home in Powder Springs. They were locked in the panic room in the basement. X, Y, Z. The answer to my brother, the Beast, and me was there. And there was A.B. The answer to Medianoche and me was there. The Beast, or Medianoche. Maybe neither was my father. I was a grown man, told myself that my answers didn't matter. I told myself that every day. I was doing this for my brother, for Andrew Sven. Yeah would be for me. Paris was colder than the souls of men, colder than a whore's heart. But this room felt like heaven. A man like me, with the things I had done since I was 7, this was as close to heaven as I'd ever get. I got back in the bed with Lola Mack and Mrs. Jones, and more soft kisses were shared. And for a moment, we were a lazy, three-headed beast. I said, one more day, then I'll pack my gun and go to Yair. Lola Mack pouted.
3 more days?
Okay. 3.
5.
4.
For real?
4.
4 more days. We can kick it at Au Petit Fer à Cheval, Le Sancerre, Chez Prune, and Paul's Cafe. We can go dancing again, too.
Mrs. Jones smiled. After you go to Yair, then to parts unknown, you'll come back to us soon, I hope. I didn't make a promise. They were too hard to keep. Then we were quiet, cuddled against each other, sleeping as the city of lights screamed to life. 2 million people were in the city. I focused on the 2 in this room. The gregarious attorney and the loquacious actress held on to me. Gun on the nightstand within reach. Gradually, reluctantly, I closed my eyes. I surrendered to the weight of exhaustion, to the need for rest. As I took shallow inhales and exhales, my trigger finger twitched. With each twitch, there were a dozen flashes in my mind. Then my mind lit up like Dubai at midnight on New Year's Day, and with each flash, I saw Mr. Midnight. Whenever a room was too dark, I saw Medianoche in the shadows. Dreams always became nightmares, and I saw our last fight. I relived that battle over and over. He was a warrior, A man who parachuted out of planes. A soldier who had gone on countless missions for his country. He was a man who had beaten bulls with his bare hands. He was the strongest man I'd ever fought. Injured, he was still as powerful as a raging bull. I'd killed many, and that battle troubled me. I remembered how Medianoche had tumbled 18 levels. He fell, and all I could hear was my own angered breathing. I had listened for some sort of outcry. There was none. Not a sound from him. Only the sound of rain and the din of Buenos Aires. We had battled, and he had barked, cursed. He had fought like a warrior who would never surrender to death. But Medianoche had fallen soundlessly, without a scream, without fighting the fall. That disturbed me. It fucking disturbed me. It always would. Like Mr. Midnight himself. It always would. Chapter 33, Los Últimos Recuerdos. Mind sharp, body weakened by the stroke, Medianoche had fought Gideon. Medianoche hadn't given a shit about his faulty brain. He would be a warrior to the end. He had been a soldier most of his life. One arm was numb, wasn't strong enough to wipe his ass clean with a roll of Elite Premium Triple Hoya toilet paper. The other arm wasn't deadened, but it wasn't much better. But he fought his oldest living enemy. Medianoche had screamed as he struggled, had tried to swing his good arm, shouted the way a soldier did when he was on the battlefield attacking his enemy head on. This would be their final battle. He would kill Gideon. But Gideon was powerful, much stronger than he looked. Gideon was as focused as he was talented. He was angry, but the surge of energy from his wrath remained under his control. This was the man who should have been a horseman. With Gideon as his XO, they would have won every battle. Gideon threw blows, connected with his chin, and Medianoche went down on one knee. It felt like he had been kicked by a horse. Gideon let him go, then returned, beat him with the saxophone. Medianoche couldn't stop him, because once again, his mind lit up. The inside of his head clicked and whirred. Memories rose. Daguerreotype memories came in black and white. He saw himself now, as he was then, barely out of high school, already enlisted, gun in his hand, fighting for his country. Had never killed a man before, but learned how to do it and walk away. After two bombs had been dropped over Japan, but before there were drones, he had fought teenagers with guns. Those teenagers had been slaughtered by teenagers with bigger guns. That summed up every war. That summed up the rich man's and politicians' entertainment. War was all he had known. He had left California, and the war in his own home, had left the beatings put on him by his old man, and went to Uncle Sam. War was what he lived for. He lived to beat others as his father had beaten him. He loved the feeling, not the war, but the feeling that came with victory. He had fought African children wielding guns manufactured in the U.S., guns now being used to slaughter American soldiers. He had almost been killed by Middle Eastern women and children turned into walking time bombs. He had smelled the scent of many deaths. But none had smelled like the arrival of his own. Blood dripped down his face, across his goatee, turned the gray hair red. Medianoche's words were garbled.
Gabrica Ortiz. Three more jobs. Nunca más.
His words went unheard. Gideon was in a rage. The whore's son had become a monster. A powerful monster. The child of a beast and a whore. Medianoche felt Gideon pull him to his feet. Heard the gaucho yell and curse. He told Medianoche he had no right to call his mother out of her goddamn name. Bloodied, incensed, words slurring, Medianoche said,
"Your mother, brothers, dead."
"Then you better fucking apologize when you see my mother in hell." The enraged gaucho grunted and deadlifted him, picked him up like he had the strength of Atlas. The gaucho held Medianoche over his head as if he weighed no more than a folding chair. That was the first time Medianoche had ever felt amazement dance with fear. Now he knew what other men had felt like when he had done this to them. He tried to fight, tried to at least make the gaucho drop him on the floor. The headaches that had marched into his life and become more frequent, more severe, the pain that heralded the blackouts, all of his troubles were caused by a tumor in his brain. A goddamn brain tumor. Frontal lobe. Made a man swear a lot, become aggressive, and lose inhibitions. But he had always cursed like a sailor, had always been aggressive, and didn't have any inhibitions left to lose. He rejected that prognosis, walked out of the hospital. Men like him lived forever, or died in battle and became mythical. Men like him didn't die in a hospital, withering away and shitting in a bedpan and being spoon-fed oatmeal. Medianoche had planned to take a fertility test to see if his vasectomy had come undone, but after the news about his brain starting to rot, he didn't care. He didn't care if he had fucked it undone and had kids all over the globe. The gaucho stepped over broken glass, grunted again with each step. Medianoche was thrown from the terrace out into the darkness of the night. As Medianoche fell from 18 stories above ground, his brain set fire, and he remembered everything in color, beautiful color. He remembered it all. Back then, he was married to his first wife. The Beast was married as well. His wife was pregnant. He remembered that Thelma had two children, twins, and she had given one to someone else to care for, had left a child overseas because she couldn't afford to feed two. The French whore told the Beast in Medianoche that one of them was the father, and the French whore had called the Beast's wife, had called Medianoche's wife, had told both women everything. She demanded money to care for her love child, her love children. 1 million for each child, or she would go to the courts and file papers. It was all fun and orgasm until a whore was pregnant. Margaret had put Thelma up to calling the wives. The Beast was pissed off, livid, and in anger, he had grabbed Margaret, caught her in the kitchen, trying to use the phone. She threatened to call the police on the both of them, threatened to tell the police they were assassins, threatened to give names of people the Beast had revealed during pillow talk, threatened to tell all the secrets she knew to the police and the news. The Beast struck Margaret with his fist, struck her hard, like she was a man, and then he had wrapped the telephone cord around her neck, begun strangling her. Thelma had screamed, tried to save her friend, had gone after the Beast with a butcher knife. But Medianoche had jumped in the way, had knocked her silly, and when she had made it back to her feet, Thelma had spat in Medianoche's face, had bared her teeth, and yelled that she was not afraid of him, yelled that she was not afraid of anyone, not anymore, and yelled that she had killed men before, said she had killed men in Paris, had killed them and run away. She started stabbing at Medianoche, stabbed at him over and over like that demonic doll in Trilogy of Terror, stabbed until Medianoche caught her wrist and wrestled the blade from her hand. He took it and twisted her arm, made her yell in pain. The Beast had ordered him to kill one whore, and he would kill the other, because he was not going to jail, and his brother Medianoche would not go to jail, not for this, and he would not pay for a whore child, would not give a dime, not to a prostitute. As two women screamed for their lives, the Beast dragged Margaret out in the backyard, dragged the West Indian woman down 3 concrete stairs, then across high grass, dirt, and more concrete. As he fell soundlessly, Medianoche remembered. He had taken his gun out, then paused to watch the Beast in his ruthlessness. The Beast had beaten Margaret until she was unable to scream, had beaten her as dogs barked, then thrown her in the trash, in a dumpster, threw her on a bed of nasty food, maggots, and flies, then fired off 5 rounds into the container. He pulled his weapon from underneath his coat and put 5 slugs into the West Indian woman. He shot a woman he used to be fond of for years. This would be the cause of Medianoche's first divorce, the cause of the Beast's separation. They had never seen the second child. They didn't know for sure if there was a second child, if it was really in Europe, or if the French whore was just trying to get more money. A whore getting pregnant was an occupational hazard, not the fault of the John. The whores had crossed the line, called wives, disrupted families, demanded money, made threats, and signed their own death certificates. Breathless, mouth bloodied, Thelma tried to get up, tried to race to the front door, but Medianoche caught her. He put his gun to her head, then put the barrel down her throat, made her gag. The French whore pissed herself. Piss rained all over Medianoche's polished shoes. He put the gun down on the table, made the French whore lick his shoes, spit shine clean. She pleaded for her life, asked,
Why are you doing this?
Medianoche replied, because some people deserve to die.
Please, I beg you, please, I am a mother. I have children. I have a son sleeping in the next room. He could be your child, your son.
And that's the problem. That's a goddamn problem.
Please, no.
You'll be where you belong in a moment.
Please.
Out back.
Please.
In the dumpster with Margaret. Then Medianoche strangled Velma.
Strangling was an intimate act, forced the one being asphyxiated to look into the killer's eyes. The murderer could watch the soul leave the victim's body. It was an intimate act of hate.
Medianoche had stared into Thelma's eyes, let her see his anger as he saw her fear. He had her suspended in the air. He was her hangman, his hands her rope. The room in her house of ill repute was her gallows. Eyes filled with tears, the French whore gagged, coughed, spat, and stared at Medianoche's face. She tried to climb, tried to fight with all her heart to live, suffocating, dying a slow, certain death. He smiled. He let her breathe. The beast came back inside the slut's house, and Thelma's reddened eyes went to him, begged to be saved. But the beast turned his back on her, turned his back on the whore he had cared for the most. The beautiful French girl he had made love to more times than he had his own wife. The whore who claimed to have birthed his children. The beast told Medianoche to kill her. To do it slowly. To make her suffer for the phone calls, for the blackmail. The beast told Medianoche to make her regret what she'd done, and then walked out the front door. The beast stood guard on the front porch, didn't want to see Thelma's well-earned death. He closed the front door. Medianoche held Thelma by her fragile neck and manhandled her petite frame around the room. She kicked over lamps, eyes wide because now she knew she was seconds from death. This would be her end, his face the last face she ever saw. But as he choked her, Medianoche looked to his left and saw her snotty-nosed son, the bastard she had fed NyQuil like it was fresh orange juice. Medianoche saw that the trick baby had picked up and was holding his gun, saw his own .22 aimed at his face, at his head, and before Medianoche could drop Thelma and attack and break the neck of the fat-headed, cereal-eating, NyQuil-drinking son of a whore, bang! Gideon was born.
This is Dion Graham. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Finding Gideon by Eric Jerome Dickey. This program was directed by Robert Kessler. Executive producer, Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2017 by Eric Jerome Dickey. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.